Good morning and welcome again to Solomon Blast here on Power Talk 1210. I'm sure there's new listeners out there that are thinking, what is Solomon on Blast? Well, it's about the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding of King Solomon applied to the confused culture we live in today. And for those new listeners, you can go to our website, solomononblast.com, to find out more about the show, along with the archives of our past shows. So you can listen to any of those past shows and get an idea of the topics we've covered. And hopefully you'll find some wisdom you can use there. But if you want to participate in today's show, you can call in anytime with your questions or comments. We always have very good input from our listeners. The number to call in, 520-750-7456. And as a reminder, you can stream the show, or any of the shows for that matter, here on Power Talk 1210 by going to PowerTalk1210.com and click on the links to the live streaming. I don't think I've mentioned it before, but you can also get the Power Talk 1210 app for your smartphone. Just go to the App Store, search for Power Talk 1210, all one word. Then you can listen from your phone to all the shows here on Power Talk 1210. Now, there will be some changes in the weekly lineup, as the Force Car Show is no longer going to be from 5 to 7 p.m. Forrest did his last show yesterday. He's leaving to pursue his dream of writing full-time and to handle some health issues. He's had his cancer's come back, so he's going to have to deal with that. So I wanted to wish Forrest the best in his ventures as an author and let him know that we'll all be praying for him and that there would be miraculous healing so he can come back and do a show in the future. He's had a great show. Everybody I've ever talked to that's listened to it has always had positive input. So, if you want to keep track of Forrest or even buy some of his books, you can check out his website. Just search for The Bashful Bloviator, and I ask everybody to keep him in your prayers. So Solomon's writings in the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes focus on wisdom. In fact, the word of wisdom shows up 52 times in Proverbs and another 27 times in Ecclesiastes. Both of those are more times than any of the other books in the Bible. And it's clear from the first chapter in Proverbs where Solomon says, to know wisdom and instruction, to receive the instruction of wisdom. And in Proverbs 4, verse 7, he says, wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom. And from Proverbs 9:10, we know the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So, does that mean that without the fear of the Lord, there is no wisdom? I'd have to say yes based on that verse. And that got me thinking about whether you could actually measure wisdom in a person. Just like there are IQ tests to measure intelligence, is there a wisdom quotient test to measure wisdom? So I did some research. Okay. Really, I just DuckDuckGo'd wisdom quotient. I know everybody says Google, but I don't use Google unless I absolutely have to. If you don't know about DuckDuckGo search page, check it out. It uses the Google search engine, but it keeps you anonymous, so Google can't track you. So there's a little bit of wisdom to help maintain some semblance of privacy in your life. Anyways, sure enough, there's an article out there from the New York Times Magazine, May 6, 2007, by Stephen Hall, entitled The Older and Wiser Hypothesis. And from there was a link to an actual wisdom quotient test. This test was developed by a sociology professor by the name of Monica Ardelt, and it attempts to assess how wise people are. The questionnaire contains 39 statements in three different dimensions, cognitive, reflective, and affective. Oscar, are you ready?
Let's do this.
No, we're not going to go through it. Too many questions do it right here. But anyways, I went through them, and I looked at the questions. Most of them really had to do with how we deal with circumstances and other people in our lives. For example, question 39 says, I sometimes find it difficult to see things from another person's point of view. And the choices are either one, definitely true for myself, mostly true, about halfway true, rarely true, or not true. And some of the questions were along the lines of what we read in Proverbs, but neither the article or the wisdom quotient test had any reference to wisdom from a spiritual sense. The article talked about a group of German scientists who boiled wisdom down to its essence, what they called the Berlin paradigm. They defined wisdom as an expert knowledge system concerning the fundamental pragmatics of life. And the interesting thing is the Germans were the first to reach what is now a widespread conclusion that there's not a lot of wisdom around. And they say in the article, of 700 people assessed, we never found a single person who gained top scores across the board. And that's probably true, especially as society becomes more and more secular. If it takes the fear of the Lord to even begin to have wisdom, and God is more and more marginalized in our culture, where's the wisdom going to come from? Man's wisdom has given us things like Darwinism, Marxism, communism, Keynesianism. Is there any hope for real wisdom? Only if we begin with the fear of the Lord. Or, as Solomon so aptly says at the end of Ecclesiastes, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. Well, we'll take a look at some of men's wisdom when we come back from these commercial breaks. Okay, we're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. In this first story from NBC News, the title is Americans are divided over the death for Boston bomber, Tsarnaev poll finds. Americans are fairly evenly divided as to whether a convicted Boston Marathon bomber should be put to death or spend the rest of his life in prison, with a slight majority preferring the ultimate penalty, according to an online poll. The poll conducted by NBC News and SurveyMonkey found 47% of those questions want Tsarnaev to be executed, while 42% would prefer he be imprisoned for life. 11% weren't sure. So when I look at what Solomon says, he says in Proverbs 16:29, a violent man entices his neighbor and leads him in a way that is not good. And the reason I say that is because everything the defense is trying to do is point out that it was his older brother that enticed him into this situation, and it's not his own fault. But the real question is, what is whether or not the death penalty is right for this kind of thing? So what do you think, Fred?
Well, I think in this situation, Doug, I think the big question, and there's a lot of things to talk about, because what this is really boiling down to is a typical death penalty dilemma, you know. And what I mean by that is it shouldn't be. This was an act of terrorism.
Right.
These two brothers conspired to kill and maim as many people as they possibly could. So I don't think we should look at this like a typical death penalty case. I think we should look at this as a terrorist attack in Boston. And I read a great article this week looking at some of the different information on this. And one of the questions asked, and I think this is really the best question I've heard so far, breakthrough for me, if we do not execute these terrorists, will they continue to interpret this as weakness in America and weakness in the West, that we are soft targets that do not have the will to resist them?
Well, if you just go back to the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not murder, right?
Right.
One of the 10, which was pretty high up there on the list. So I think from my perspective, it doesn't matter whether it's a terrorist attack. It doesn't matter whether he did it for fun or whatever. They've murdered people, and the number of people shouldn't matter either, whether it's one or whether it was 15. The fact that he committed the murder, and it was premeditated, obviously, to an extensive degree, says that the death penalty is the right way to approach this, because otherwise maybe not in the sense of a weakness, but it's a deterrent to people continuing that kind of behavior.
Well, I follow your reasoning, and I accept it on lots of other levels, but I do think, and I hold the position that because it is a terror act of terrorism, that there are further implications by not dealing with it correctly. Now, you can't make a direct correlation. I mean, sure, studies have been done where they basically, where societies where they implement the death penalty effectively does make some kind of impact on crime in certain areas, and yeah. they try to attribute it to all these other things. But in this case, we are under attack. We are in a war right now. And because we're in a war, I think it's imperative that we look at it from a different point of view. Now, having said that, you know, you can go to some of the laws, like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which is one of the most misquoted statements that Jesus made in the New Testament.
Right.
Jesus wasn't actually referring to the law itself. He was saying, he prefaced that by saying, you have heard. So he wasn't talking about what was written. What he was talking about was the way that had been applied so liberally to say, I can get even with anybody I want. God says it's okay. That's not what that law was about. That law was about making sure that when a crime was judged, that the punishment was commensurate with the crime.
Not that.
That you couldn't just do anything you wanted. You just
right.
couldn't
you can't always
kill
get
somebody.
Vengeance.
Right. You couldn't chop somebody's hand off for taking right. something. That's why right. they don't do that in Bible-based cultures, because it's not commensurate. So it was actually there to regulate, not to give people the license to go get revenge anytime they wanted to.
Now, there was a case back in World War II where there were some German spies that came on the U.S. shores, and we may even have talked about this in the past, but they were found out by a Coast Guard patrol, a young guy that was walking the beach patrolling for the Coast Guard, and he saw these guys bury their boat, and they kind of paid him off behind the scenes to not say anything, but he went ahead and reported these guys. Within, I think it was less than 4 months, almost all of them had been executed. So it was a direct message to Germany in the middle of a war
right.
that this is how we handle people that are attempting to attack the U.S. on our own soil.
What about Julius and Ethel Rosenberg? They were found guilty of espionage, and they were summarily put to death. And there was lots of outcry and people claiming they were innocent and whatnot. But the fact is, we were in the middle of a Cold War, and there was very real intrigue happening, you know, between the Soviet Union and America. And they had to make a decision. They had to deal with it. And, you know, I think that decision has been vindicated historically. I think it, especially since the fall of the Soviet Empire, the information that came out that they were, in fact, spies. And so, you know, this is uncomfortable, but I think you can't lose sight of the fact that we are at war. And I think these people have to be dealt with. My question is why is Major Nadel Hassan still alive, collecting six figures a year?
Well,
Doug?
Because it was a workplace violence issue, according to the president. I mean, this past week, they gave these guys, the people that were attacked by him, the Purple Heart for those that were wounded. And in reality, it really wasn't a combat situation. Yes, they were soldiers, and yes, they were shot, but it was by somebody that was, at that point in time, effectively on the same team, right?
Okay, now
friendly fire.
Let's analyze this for a second.
But he's still alive.
Right. They gave Purple Hearts to the victims, which implies that it was battle-related. Or battle-related.
Right.
War-related. But on Hassan's side of the ball, it was just a workplace outburst. He had a bad day. It sounds like it's kind of inconsistent, don't you think?
Absolutely, compared to what Timothy McVeigh received.
Yeah, so what happened to the Timothy McVeigh model? Why can't we apply that model across the board to these other terrorists?
And I think a lot of it has to do with maybe their belief systems. And maybe it's...
You mean that Timothy McVeigh was a right guy with a crew cut?
Yeah, what would be considered the right-wing, radical, Christian, you know, against the government.
Which
so you
he actually
get rid of
wasn't.
Those, which he wasn't, no, but that's the implications you get from that.
That's a worse form of terrorism?
Yes, that radical Christians or right-wing people that are anti-government is a worse form of terrorism than somebody like the Boston bombers that were, well, they were just confused kids, according to some of these
people.
With
Rolling Stone magazine appeal. You know, and I think this is really where the conflict starts to get, you know, starts to get uniquely American. We go from the war on terrorism to our own culture war, where there are people that want to symbolically identify with certain people and somehow defend, you know, infuse them with their beliefs or what they, you know, with their worldview, and they represent symbolically what they'd like to believe about the world. And that's what's happening right now. Because Tsarnaev is young, the whole Rolling Stone cover thing, it really does say a lot more about American culture than it's not just, oh, they just, you know, ran a cover. It was kind of cool. No, it shows you something about today's culture. That if somebody looks a certain way or fits a certain image, even though they could be just as evil as Hitler, it doesn't matter. That they're marketable and they're useful, and we can use them to say what we want to say about the world. And I think it's terrible. Personally, I agree with you. I think the guy needs to walk the plank, and I think that's our responsibility. My whole angle is that this is a war crime, and it needs to be addressed as such.
The one thing that kind of set me off on this with regards to the discussion was there was a Fox News discussion about the fact that they were trying to figure out, well, should he or shouldn't he be killed, executed, given the death penalty. And one of the commentators made the comment that he thought they should keep him alive and yet create an environment whereby he relives the same level of pain and suffering that the victims of the bombing live on a day-by-day basis until he finally does die. And the reason he gave for that was because he doesn't believe that there is a hell after death. And I just thought that here's somebody that, because he doesn't believe in the truth, the wisdom of what God has said in his word, he's taken his own approach to how he would deal with things, man's approach to solving this problem. And when you listen to this guy, he sounds not much less, well, how should I say it? Aggressive, violent as Tsarnaev himself. When you consider that what his mind had to go through to come up with this thought process of how do you torture this guy for the rest of his life.
And what he did, which is a fascinating, when you mentioned this to me, it fascinated me, because what he actually did was isolate, and this is ironic, but he isolated the humanitarian aspect of the death penalty. Because the death penalty was employed as a form of punishment, but punishment that lasted only to the end of this life, which recognized that person could get right with their maker and enter into the next phase with a clean slate. And that's, you know, you say, oh, that sounds like a joke. But really, if you think about it, there's a lot of, there's a humanitarian aspect to that.
Because the Bible does say that God desires that none should perish, right?
Right. And the story of the thief on the cross who was fulfilling punishment for a real crime. So the idea there, it has worked itself out to the way that we punish death row criminals, right? We give them a meal. Mm-hmm. They invite some kind of minister or whoever to come and say a few words. We give them the opportunity to say a few words, how sorry they are. So what that does is it humanizes the process. You don't just cut somebody's head off and scream. You let them walk through the protocols to the end of their plank. They pay for their crime. You divert blood feuds that way, when someone has to pay a price for their crime. And you give that person an opportunity to recapture some level of their humanity.
And you give them that opportunity and to repent. And
so
decide.
Inadvertently, this Fox analyst understood that and wanted to take that away.
Right. He wants the guy to suffer and never have the opportunity to change his view on what he did and whether it was right or wrong.
But you know what? I do understand this much, and that is the utter frustration with the anti-death penalty lobby that loves to make martyrs out of these terrible people, you know? And I understand that side of it, and I can see why people could begin to feel and think these things. For example, you read the story this week of the third grade teacher that was suspended because she had her kids write get well cards to Mumia, the cop killer, the Philadelphia story, the guy that was convicted of killing a cop, you know,
27
years ago. He's been
that.
On death row ever since, and he's become a celebrity amongst that group.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he never have done it, even though all the proof is there and whatever. But the point is that there's always going to be those people out there that no matter what are going to glorify these criminals, are going to lift them up, and they're going to project onto them what they want to believe about the universe. And so I can see why this is so infuriating to people like him.
Yeah, and there was a statement made in a book I'd read before, and I found it. And this book is called The Principles of Conduct by John Murray. And he says in here, he says, as a violation of the summary commandment, and he's talking about thou shalt not kill, and the summary one of thou shalt love thy neighbor as yourself, he says it's a unique category because as far as this would be concerned, there's no way of being reconciled to the victim of our wrongdoing. So you can't reconcile because there's no way of getting his forgiveness after you've killed him. And as far as relations to the victim are concerned, he says murder is, it's impossible to remediate that sin. You can't get that forgiveness from your victim. So,
well said.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be back after Blaze News or Arizona News, one of the two, here on Power Talk 1210. Solomon on Blast. Okay, we're back here on Power Talk 1210 with Solomon on Blast. Yeah, Puff the Magic Dragon. Well, in this next story here, I'm wondering how much wisdom there is. Proverbs 30, verse 15-16, Solomon says, there are three things that are never satisfied, and one of those is the earth that is not satisfied with water. And this article came out, Weekly Standard this past week, says marijuana plants soak up billions of gallons of water in California. So we think maybe it isn't all about global warming and everything. According to the article, California's terrible drought has become, just like about everything else in the United States, a political issue. Many liberals have taken to blaming anthropogenic climate change for the drought, while some conservatives have placed the blame at the feet of liberal environmentalists. The political point scoring is tiring and just plain silly, given the drought is almost certainly a result of natural processes that we as humans, conservatives and liberals alike, have precious little to do with. But another problem is that our partisan puglists are conflating two separate issues, the drought, which is the lack of rainfall that California has suffered over the past 4 years, and the water shortages, which may have indeed some man-made causes. And they're saying that all of the marijuana being grown in California And the water that is needed to grow that marijuana is causing these billions of gallons of water to disappear. So is it Puff the Magic Dragon really the problem by the sea there? Well, then.
I have to say, Doug, this is a delicious irony from my standpoint. But, to watch these guys squirm over this big green dilemma is kind of fun. And that's terrible because I love California, lived a lot of my life there, and I don't like to see it brown. But which way do you turn? If you are, you're a hipster greenie, which way do you go? Do you go with the watering your lawn, or do you go with, growing marijuana plants?
Well, supposedly, according to this article, there are approximately 17.5 million outdoor marijuana plants in the state. So I would say a lot of these people are going for the marijuana instead of the green lawn out front.
One thing is for sure, when you smoke a lot of weed, you really don't care if your lawn is dying after a while, you know? So I guess in that way, it's kind of a soothing trade-off. But I think, weed's not even legal in California. I mean, it's medical.
For medicine.
Medically, it is. But it's not like Washington and Colorado that have full-blown marijuana freedom laws. Therefore, I think it's low priority, don't you? I mean, how can you prioritize something? There's so many other forms of medication, if that's what you want to say about it, that why would you put billions of dollars, gallons of water into something that really is precious at that time? Why wouldn't you just put that end of the medical spectrum,
it becomes
suspend its importance for a while and just, what you got to do, save the water.
Well, there's other articles out there that are indicating that it's not even just that aspect of it, but it's the amount of water that's being allowed to drain off into the ocean because of just these small fish that they're afraid are going to become extinct. And so the EPA is out there causing all kinds of havoc because of that aspect of it. But they do have a solution, and whether or not they would allow them to use it, there's actually, within the EPA, there's a group, a committee called what they call the God Squad, that can actually override the EPA rules and allow things to take place such that it would be okay for these species to go extinct, this particular species of fish. So maybe they need to invoke the God Squad to save California here.
Well, it goes to the California government, the California Assembly, which seems to get sillier and sillier with every session. I was living in San Francisco when they had to add one runway to SFO, and it began the project at a certain budget. But because of that, the EPA getting involved and trying to, I'm not exaggerating, trying to salvage some kind of butterfly or something. Something that silly. They actually ended up suspending the project for months, and on top of that, the budget almost doubled just because of that. Because you got people working, you got time, you got people on, you've got construction contractors, you got all kinds of people that are just waiting to get the job done, and these ridiculous policies just, The only reason they're even tolerated is because California is such a prosperous state with an incredible, financial infrastructure. They're losing small businesses by the day. Even as we speak, people are leaving the state because these ridiculous policies they just continue to eat away at the middle class, basically.
So my question is, how much of an impact is this going to have on the produce and the agriculture that comes out of California, because they supply a lot of the produce, agriculture.
Oh, the San Joaquin Valley used to be the salad bowl of the world.
Right. So with these kind of restrictions, how much of an impact is it going to have on the rest of the country that's buying their produce, the vegetables and the fruits and everything? I can see where that aspect of it could cause a pretty high spike in price of food and inflation.
Oh, absolutely.
What's more important, I guess, in terms of their approach, And if people are willing to pay whatever price they want to charge them for water, why can't they do what they want with it?
Well, another thing, too, is, you know, I've lived in the Valley and in San Francisco. And so another thing you see is that the emphasis is always on the coast, because that's where all your tourism is, in L.A. and San Francisco areas. But you go inland a few miles, 60 miles or so, and it's brown and it's ugly and things are dying. You know, I think the people of California need to find a solution to representing themselves against these hyper-progressive interests that are camped out on the coasts.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the articles talks about where Governor Jerry Brown, he actually found a spot that was brown and would normally have snow on it to do his press conference so that he could make the biggest impact, that the ground was dead. And I would imagine if there wasn't snow there, it'd be nice and green. So was it dead just because the snow had melted off and it hadn't greened up, or was it dead because there wasn't enough water to keep it going?
Well, this time of year, things start turning brown anyway. I mean, this time of year over there. So I think, yeah, what are you going to do? Sue God for not sending rain? I mean, come on. I mean, who are they blaming here?
Exactly. And the thing is, it says that they're really going after the individuals, that the agricultural groups aren't going to be, they would be exempt from the new rules, and they're going to enforce them through the state and local water agencies. So it just, again, goes back to the fact that if you haven't got the wisdom to look at things ahead of time, and this has happened in the past, 2009, they had the same situation. If you haven't got that wisdom to look at things, you just keep repeating the same errors over and over again.
Yeah, that's right. And I do think so much of this is politically based, and the people that make the choices for the state would like to believe a lot of things, but when it really push comes to shove and you go into a crisis, when things are good, when there's a lot of rain, everybody looks good. Yeah. It all looks good. But when there isn't, that's when you find out how smart the people are that are ruling you.
So if they're going to exempt the farmers from this, does that include the marijuana farmers? That's the question.
That's the question. I think asparagus is more important than weed.
Yeah. All right. We'll be back with more Solomon on Blast right after these commercial breaks.
Together they would travel on a boat with billowed sail. Jackie kept the lookout perched on Puff's gigantic tail. Noble kings and princes would bow.
All right, we're back. Or not. Am I back? Okay, now I can hear myself. All right, we're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. This article that was out there was actually kind of in reference to Easter and comes from a lady by the name of Brittany Cooper. She says in her article, well, the title of it, which I'll make sure I get it right without causing too much of a problem. She says the title of the article is "The Right's Made-Up God, How Bigots Invented a White Supremacist Jesus." And like I said, she was referring to what was going on with regards to Easter and the fact that, as she claims to be a Christian, that she doesn't believe in this, what she says is a white supremacist Jesus, instead of what she considers the Jesus that she knows through the Bible. And so she's very, very much attacking any kind of approach to religion from, I guess you'd have to say, from the white right.
Well, you know, I think it's also important to bring up here that Brittany Cooper is African-American. And so this gives the impression that somehow she speaks for the entire African-American community, which she does not. See, I'm involved in this world. The African-American community, by and large, is one of the most Bible-based, you know, embraced, I should say, communities. If you want to use the phrase God-fearing, people that value these things, that value the fundamentals of Christianity, not fundamentalism, but, you know, the basics of Bible-based Christianity. So she sounds like, because of her Wanda Sykes shtick, she sounds like somehow she's the spokesperson. But in reality, I think she's channeling the sentiments of the anti-Christian North, White, East, Progressive a lot more than she is the actual African-American community. And that, to me, is the irony of all of this, that she's promoted all, and she has some very explosive things to say.
Oh, yes, and you know, she seems to be able to get away with some of the comments she makes in her article. She says, this white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, gun-toting, Bible-quoting Jesus of the religious right is a god of their own making. I call this, and she uses the little g god, the god of white supremacy and patriarchy. This God isn't the God that I serve. He might be biblical, but he's also, and then she uses a term that ends with the word whole, but I won't say that.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, you know, the whole Wanda Sykes shtick, that somehow this woman just telling it like it is and whatnot. Here's what I really, when I read through a couple of articles, this one and another one, I had the thought that came to my head was that if Norman Lear, remember him, the guy that produced All in the Family, Good Times, The Jeffersons, if Norman Lear was writing TV shows, producing TV shows in 2015 with today's sensibilities, I think Brittany Cooper would have been one of his characters. You know, in other words, it's got these Northeastern anti-Christian ideas, and they basically do them in blackface. You know, that's what Norman Lear used to do.
Mm-hmm.
He used to put all these ideas in these characters, and people thought that that was, you know, that
it was humor.
It was humor, but I can imagine her giving these lines with a laugh track. It's kind of like Florence the Maid goes Ivy League. You know,
uh-huh.
I mean, it sounds one thing. I want you to get my point very clearly here. I'm not talking about some of the concerns that people have in every community. I'm talking about what she is saying is distinctly Northeast white liberal, anti-Christian ideas. I want to make that very clear. And it sounds, because of the way she's saying it, that it's, oh, she's just speaking for the whole community. She's not.
Right.
She basically has been promoted and placed in that position to say these things from her point of view. They do it in politics all the time.
Right.
You know what
you
I mean?
Get the person that won't get attacked for saying For saying these things, and get them to say it rather than to say it.
Yes, and
yourself.
You write it in their voice.
Yeah.
And they do it when they do it when politicians run for office, right? They'll do it in Arizona.
Yep.
They'll get a Spanish speaking person to go out there and talk about their position on something. And, you know, and even if it's a commercials in English, they'll use an accent
uh-huh.
to kind of make you feel like this person is related to you. And, you know, it's an old game. And she's getting play because she sounds like, oh, she's just so down to earth, telling us like it is. Nah, she's just saying what these people want her to say. That's my opinion. That's my personal opinion.
But I don't think she realizes that she's being manipulated to that extent. She, from the article, you know, she really believes the things she says in there. She says, we need to reclaim the narrative of Jesus' life and death from the evangelical right. They've not been good stewards of the narrative. They've pimped Jesus' death to support the global spread of American empire vis-a-vis war, missions, free trade, all the things that you hear from the liberal left.
Absolutely.
That says, you know, we're warmongers and everything else.
I'm not saying she's not a Kool-Aid drinker. I'm not saying she doesn't believe this stuff.
Right.
She's saturated in a way of thinking that is not authentically the African-American community. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. And her ending point on there, which is why we kind of led into this with the Die, Die, Die track from Metallica. She says, let us mark this holy week by declaring the death to the unholy trinity of white supremacist, capitalist, heteropatriarchy, and once these systems die, they may die once and for all, never to be resurrected. But I say to her in response, the system that we have the capitalism, the Christianity that created this country has created a country that a lot of the world would like to come to. And for her to take that approach that it's been nothing but negative on the whole world.
Right, to characterize all of that as some form of white supremacy is just... It's disingenuous to say. And it's slanderous. But maybe she can be encouraged that maybe her plan is happening. They did let a wicket open in prayer at one of the state houses this week. So maybe things are looking up for Brittany.
Great. And she attacks the right with regards to the whole sexuality for women and gay people and everything. And maybe she's got some hope because now there's a transgender bathroom in the White House or a non-gender bathroom in the White House that anybody that wants to use can use.
So. Yeah. I guess maybe Brittany will have her own TV show one day.
Frightening thought. Anyways, we'll be back with our final One Greater Than Solomon segment here on Solomon on Blast, Power Talk 1210. We'll be back. Okay, we're back on our One Greater Than Solomon segment here on Power Talk 1210, Solomon on Blast. In this article, God's Message in Chinese Painting, there's a group of Christian artists in Beijing that hope to influence their culture through artwork infused with the gospel. Roger Cui stood in front of a series of paintings depicting wrinkled, smiling faces, some missing teeth, others with their eyes crinkled shut over a backdrop of Bible verses written in Chinese calligraphy. And he described the faces as the elderly men and women he met at a rural nursing home owned by Christians in the Anhui province. And when the elderly first arrived, they were despondent about having been abandoned by their children. So in China, who traditionally they're required to care for their parents in old age, but now I guess in this modern China, these kids can just abandon their parents in these homes. But as the caregivers sang hymns and shared the gospel, a majority of these people came to profess Christ. Difference is obvious just by looking at their faces, he said. He's the head of a Cornerstone Art Associates, head of the Cornerstone Art Associates, which is a group of six Christian artists who live in a 200-person artist colony on the outskirts of Beijing. Formerly, he was an atheist police officer, but he was moved by the love and the prayers of his mother's church when his daughter was hospitalized back in 2003. He says that sitting by her sick bed, he started contemplating the purpose of life and what happens after death. After his daughter was completely healed, he and half his family professed Christ. And over the next 5 years, he threw off bad habits of drinking, gambling, and smoking. And with his new purpose to live for Christ, he quit his job and opened an artist studio with the aim to evangelize through art. So after moving to the art village last year, he bumped into several other Christian artists, and they began gathering together to paint, pray, and fellowship. One of their members of their group, Grace Wang, lives in Inner Mongolia, but found him through an online Christian message board. They've hosted their first exhibit at a recent Christian training conference in Hong Kong, and they've displayed a mix of both Western and Eastern painting styles. The interesting thing is, in this article, it says that a lot of these people a lot of these artists have deep roots in Buddhism, and as they study Buddhism to excel in the craft, many end up partaking in the faith of Christianity, and that's the road that another artist in the group took when he started feeling dissatisfied with China's materialism. With a group of other artists, he rode an overnight train to Beijing to visit these sites, and on the way over, a woman seated next to him started telling him about the gospel, and although he couldn't really recall exactly what she said, he remembered being impressed that this elderly woman had enough energy to chatter on about Jesus, even as the lights of the train turned off and others fell asleep. So he was unconvinced by Buddhism, especially as he noticed how the faith changed over time. When he returned home, he took up the old woman's offer to attend her church. He went in, heard the gospel, and felt that this is what I was looking for. I finally found it, he said. So the wisdom can only come from God, the beginning and even to the end. And even through pictures in China, people that have heard the gospel see the difference in people's lives and make that decision. We also have that opportunity to make the decision to follow Christ. And that's what we should be doing. So until next week, think wisely, follow Christ.